WJCT in Jacksonville. This is our weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. I'm your host, Vince Kong, and this is Redux. It's Friday, October 28th. With the 2016 presidential elections a little more than a week away, we're going to look at, well, the November elections. But rather than dwell on the drama surrounding the main card, we're going to look at issues that matter to the First Coast as well as the rest of the state. On this episode of Redux, we're going to pose the question, should these folks keep their jobs on the Florida Supreme Court? We'll also examine the issues of tax breaks for disabled police and firefighters, as well as low-income seniors, and if Duval County is ready for the legalization of slot machines. Then, Florida schools are facing a teacher shortage, and some lawmakers want to make it easier to transition into a career in the classroom. And finally, visual art for the blind? Huh? Stay tuned. But first, an update. The Jacksonville City Council voted unanimously earlier this week to spend $7.5 million on restoring sand dunes that were destroyed by Hurricane Matthew. Jacksonville University Marine Science Professor Jeremy Stalker says that the dunes have several important functions.
They protect any property that's behind the sand dune. So they act sort of as sources for sand. If there have been storms, sand can be remobilized from the dunes back onto the beach. They actually help protect the beach itself.
Stalker also says the restoration process is more than just piling sand on the beach. Because dunes are naturally made over centuries, the sand needs plenty of time to settle and compact. Proper restoration requires years of layering and rebuilding vegetation. Florida voters are deciding on property tax breaks for disabled police and firefighters, as well as low-income seniors. WJCT's Jessica Palumbo examines Amendments 3 and 5 as we look at the issues most important to Florida voters.
In October of 2005, Orange County Sheriff's Deputy Adam Pierce was patrolling part of Orlando's Orange Blossom Trail.
It was a high-crime, high-drug area.
At age 25, Pierce was already a six-year veteran of the force.
And I enjoyed working that area.
One Monday, he caught a drug dealer in the act, and the guy tried to flee. Another deputy shot the suspect with a taser in the right arm.
And as fate would have it, he was left-handed. And he had a gun in his left pocket. And we didn't know it. He was laying on the ground and started to get up like he was going to run. So I ran towards him to tackle him, basically. And he pulled out the gun, he turned around and fired twice.
The first bullet hit Pierce in the top of his head. The second tore through his neck and lungs before shattering one of his vertebrae. A decade later, he remains paralyzed from the waist down, with nerve damage shooting intense pain throughout his body. When that pain became too much to work recently, he retired from the Sheriff's Office Forensics Unit. He gets disability payments, but his family is on a pretty tight budget. If voters pass Amendment 3, the property tax bill on Pierce's home would disappear. That would save him roughly $4,200 a year, he says. And the exemption would go for all first responders permanently and totally disabled in the line of duty. Pierce and his wife, Crystal, know exactly how they would spend that extra money.
Food. We have seven kids. And our food budget right now is $1,200 a month.
Central Florida Republican Representative Larry Metz sponsored the bill that got the Amendment 3 exemption on the ballot.
That would put first responders in that category in the same treatment as U.S. military veterans who are disabled from a wartime disability.
Metz says a disabled cop in his district, Raul Perez, contacted him with the idea. It passed the legislature unanimously.
And I think that's a great example of the process working just the way it was intended to work.
It's not clear how many first responders will qualify statewide because the legislature would have to clarify the definition of permanently and totally disabled. In Jacksonville's Duval County, property appraiser Jerry Holland estimates 50 police and firefighters would be in that special exempt group.
They're getting a freer ride. than those who may not get any exemption at all.
He says the Amendment 3 exemption could take $125,000 in revenue away from his county, school district, and other taxing bodies. He calls that an insignificant amount. But on the other hand, it's on top of many tax breaks already on the books. Another proposal on the November ballot would expand one of those breaks for low-income seniors. They can already be exempted from property tax if they live in the same home for 25 years. Under Amendment 5, local governments could let them keep that exemption, even if their home's value rises above a current threshold of $250,000. Holland says as the exemptions add up, cities and counties can start to feel the squeeze.
They have to say, okay, do I spend as much money in this area of arts and parks and this over here? Or maybe eventually all these exemptions become straws on the camel's back.
Then, he says, they might decide to raise taxes. Legislative analysts say it's hard to estimate the total statewide cost of Amendments 3 and 5 because local governments and state lawmakers would have to take further action before they would take effect. Jessica Palumbo, WJCT News.
With Florida schools in the grip of a teacher shortage, some state lawmakers want to make it easier for people to switch careers and move into the classroom. Now, WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride takes a closer look at changing teacher certification rules.
Jacksonville's Lee High School has had its share of teacher vacancies.
I think we hired approximately 15 teachers over the summer, and quite a few of them were in the math department.
Principal Scott Snyder says positions in math and other STEM subjects are the hardest to fill, and that's true across the state. So many schools are recruiting professionals in STEM fields. A couple years ago, Cameron Phillip Edmonds was working at a software firm just outside of Jacksonville.
I got kind of sick of cubicle life.
So we interviewed at a Duval County middle school to teach computer coding.
Within about 30 minutes, I was offered a job and I took it.
South Florida Republican Representative Manny Diaz Jr. wants to make it easier for people like Phillip Edmonds to move into teaching. Right now, all you need to become a teacher in Florida is a bachelor's degree in any subject. But within 3 years, new hires have to take courses to learn how to teach. They have to pay for those classes themselves. Diaz says that requirement might not make sense for a new teacher who's doing well without the extra courses.
You're a hit. It goes well. You're performing for kids. And then I tell you, well, you got to go, within 3 years, you got to go back to school and take 5 classes. That's going to be a huge disincentive.
In the last legislative session, he helped pass a bill that exempts high-performing STEM teachers from the required extra classes, but only if they have advanced degrees. He wants to look into expanding that to people who have STEM bachelor's degrees, too. But career switcher Cameron Phillip Edmonds thinks it's already too easy to become a teacher. He says knowing how to code didn't prepare him to teach kids how to code.
It was scary, especially because I had no real training to it. In fact, my first training on classroom management came in November of that year after I'd been teaching for about 3 months.
He says he didn't know how to deal with students who weren't interested in coding or who weren't even reading on grade level. He quit his teaching job after just 1 year. Representative Diaz does say all teachers should get some kind of professional development. Mark Pudlow, with a statewide teachers union, the Florida Education Association, wants to make sure the training begins before a teacher steps in front of a class.
You need to understand a little bit about how children learn and what kind of strategies work best as far as helping children learn.
Diaz's Democratic opponent, Yvette Gonzalez-Pekovich, says reducing requirements for new teachers might help with the shortage, but she'd rather concentrate on giving teachers better pay and more autonomy in the classroom. A 2016 study from the Independent Learning Policy Institute found pay is a big factor in teacher recruitment and retention. So are programs like paid residencies that let new teachers apprentice under experienced instructors. Dan Weisberg with the national nonprofit The New Teacher Project says other options don't cost a thing.
Recognizing that a great teacher is great, asking him or her to please come back and continue to teach in the school.
Good morning. How's it going? You doing all right?
Yes, sir.
Back at Jacksonville's Lee High School, Principal Scott Snyder says he's used those kinds of low-cost strategies and most of his teachers have stuck around.
truthfully, when I talk to teachers and people that leave our profession, it's not because of the financial means. It's usually because they don't feel supported and they don't feel that they're respected and valued.
Representative Manny Diaz still wants to explore the possibility of lowering teacher certification barriers. In November, he'll find out if he'll get to keep his House seat and move his idea forward. I'm Lindsay Kilbride in Jacksonville.
Slot machines could soon be legal in Duval County, depending on how voters decide. County referendum number one on the November 8th general election ballot asks whether pari mutuel betting facilities in Duval County can install slot machines. Pari mutuel refers to betting pools where winners split the collected wagers minus a percentage that goes to the house. The only Jacksonville pari mutuel facility is Best Bet on Monument Road in Arlington. Customers there can play poker and bet on televised Greyhound dog races. The idea of putting a slot machine referendum on the ballot in Duval County came from Jacksonville City Councilman Aaron Bowman.
In Duval County, Jacksonville, we have one pari mutuel facility, and that's Best Bet. So the way the state language reads that if we get this approved, that we could have slot machines only in that facility. So it's not going to be like they're in multiple locations.
But even if slot machines win in Duval County, they could still lose. The Florida Supreme Court is weighing a case that claims a legislature must decide whether slots are allowed, not people at the local level. Gretna Racing, a pari mutuel facility in rural Gadsden County, argued that the law lets counties put the question to voters in the form of a referendum, something the state disputes. The outcome will affect at least six counties where slot machines have already been approved, seven if Duval County voters say yes to County Referendum 1 on the November 8th ballot. Okay, First Coast voters have between 7 and 9 judges on their November ballots with the question, should these people retain their jobs? Now WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride will tell us how to make an informed choice.
Several appeals judges and 3 Florida Supreme Court justices are on the November ballot. It's called a merit retention election. Florida law requires appellate judges to show up on the ballot every 6 years. They're originally appointed by the governor, while circuit and county judges are elected. Judges don't have term limits. A judge can serve in Florida until he or she reaches the age of 70. And the races are nonpartisan. Judges are not allowed to campaign to maintain impartiality. So how can voters learn about the judges up for retention? One way is to look at how Florida lawyers think the judges are performing. The Florida Bar asks lawyers to rank judges on 8 attributes, including temperament and freedom from prejudice. This year, just under 6,000 lawyers responded, and all judges were given high marks ranging from 79 to 92% approval. An individual breakdown of scores and links to the bios of the judges can be found at WJCTnews.org. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
And finally, Jacksonville's Kummer Museum recently received a National Lifetime Achievement Award for making its art accessible to people with disabilities. Washington's Kennedy Center recognized the Kummer for long-running programs like the Arts Festival for Kids with Disabilities and a monthly art-making group for the blind called Women of Vision. WJCT's Jessica Palumbo attended the women's latest meeting to find out what keeps them engaged with visual art, even though they can't see.
Every meeting starts with story time. In a classroom at the Kummer Museum, women are telling each other about their favorite shoes they've ever owned.
I was raised by my grandparents, and Papa was just a cotton farmer, so we didn't have no money. So we got a pair of shoes when it was time to go to school.
That's Renee Bird taking her turn at the mic. She and the other women of vision listen and commiserate before they make art. Bird's been a part of the group for 2 years.
This is where I come to be with my family that I don't live with at home. And we just share and share. And everybody, all the women, of course, are visually impaired. So we all understand where everybody's been.
That sense of community was what Women of Vision's founder had in mind nearly 2 decades ago. Sister Elizabeth Fiority is blind herself. She greets me with a handshake.
Nice to put a feeling to the voice I hear on the radio all the time.
Fiority approached the Kummer about creating the program with the help of a grant from her religious order, the Cincinnati Dominicans.
Now 83, she still comes monthly.
Yes, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I've grown old with all these women.
She says the museum pays the women's cab fare so they can get here, and it creates annual exhibits of what they make, like photographs they took in the garden outside with the help of sighted instructors.
When the museum mats and frames these pictures and we have an exhibit, they look like $1 million.
On a pedestal outside the classroom, brightly glazed ceramic pots are on display, another of their projects. The Cummers Accessibility Coordinator and Women of Vision art teacher Matthew Patterson says three-dimensional projects are important.
Because it lends itself so nicely to this kind of population, something you can touch and you can feel the whole way through. So we do some two-dimensional work, which is good, but once you're finished with it or once you're framed, you kind of lose that connection to it.
Patterson also guides them on museum tours, describing the art in great detail. Some women remember colors from before they lost their sight. Others rely on their hands. Fiority and Bird recently enjoyed a bronze statue that way.
Sometimes we've even had those latex gloves, you know, so if we're going to touch some sculpture or something.
But we get to do it. We get to do it because we can't see it any other way.
The Women of Vision's artwork is on display at the Cummer through the end of October. They meet one Friday every month. Jessica Palumbo, WJCT News.
And that's our show. You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. All right, the blues isn't just about heartbreak. The blues has a long history with voodoo and the macabre, usually in reference to some sort of culture dilemma or more personal issues of the artist who sings them. Join host Andrew Wickman this Monday for Blues Horizons Halloween special at 11 p.m. on 89.9 FM. Here's a sample of what you'll hear. Please enjoy. And that concludes Redux. I'm Vince Kong. Thank you for listening.